Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today about the tremendous work of six hospitals in the state of Florida who, along with 18 other hospitals in Illinois, Texas, New York, and California, participated in the March of Dimes Big Five project to eliminate non-medically indicated deliveries before 39 weeks gestational age. Before I begin, I want to acknowledge my collaborators and colleagues who are listed there. Lori Reeves, who was the state program director for the March of Dimes in Florida and is now the manager of quality improvement initiatives for the southeast region of the March of Dimes, and Drs. William Sappenfield and John Curran of the University of South Florida. All of us are part of the Florida Perinatal Quality Collaborative. I have no financial relationships to disclose. To briefly provide you with some context for this work, preterm birth continues to be a problem in the United States, but early term deliveries have been a growing problem over the last few decades. Researchers have begun to explore and better understand the risks to babies born in the early term between 37 and 39 weeks. I'll be showing a few slides that are courtesy of the March of Dimes, and I'm grateful for their permission to share them with you. And this is one of them. They look different from mine. We know prematurity poses significant risks to the neonate, but it's becoming increasingly clear that there's not only a risk to babies born in the early preterm period, and that is between 34 and 37 weeks, but there's an increased risk for babies that are born at what's considered the early term period, defined as deliveries taking place between 37 weeks and 0 days and 38 weeks and 6 days. And this is particularly for babies who are born electively, that is, without any sort of medical reason to intervene. This slide shows you the changing distribution of births to a lower gestational age over the last 16 years in the United States. You can see that there's a sharp decline in deliveries that occur after 39 weeks, but quite a sharp increase in births occurring before that, particularly between 37 and 38 weeks gestation, but especially 37 and 38 weeks. And remember, we consider those to be term babies. Similarly, in the state of Florida, when you look at the distribution of gestational age of births less than 39 weeks, you can see over the last two decades that births in the early term have increased from about 20 to 30% of births less than 39 weeks, while the preterm rates and the late preterm rates have basically remained flat. They maybe have squiggled a little bit in the late preterm. My colleague, Dr. Curran, likes to call this slide, he calls it the calling attention to the red zone in Florida OB practice slide, because many of the babies that are delivered at 37 and 38 weeks are actually delivered by an electively scheduled induction or electively scheduled cesarean section, which means there's absolutely no medical reason to intervene. Using birth certificate data as a surrogate measure to get a better understanding of the prevalence of these births in our state, we find there's an average rate of 11% of non-medically indicated delivered births under 39 weeks among all live-born term births. But when you look at that data and you split it up into fifths, so you can get a better idea of some of the variation among hospitals. And this is showing you 120 hospitals in the state of Florida. We have a wide range in rates, with that top line, so the top quintile, having rates of non-medically indicated deliveries ranging from 14 to 26% of their term deliveries. So almost a quarter of the babies that are born in that time period are born with no medical indication. So despite the limitations of using the birth certificate data, this is one of the ways that we've been able to compare and see how things are working with different hospitals. It's the only way we really can compare hospitals to each other in the state at this time. And you can see that while the numbers have started to move downward from about 2008, there's still obviously a problem in the state, especially for those top three lines. Oh, and I went too far. For those of you that don't already know, the idea of reducing elective deliveries, these scheduled inductions and C-sections in healthy pregnancies before 39 weeks is not something that's new. In fact, the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Academy of Pediatrics have recommended against such deliveries for over three decades. The National Quality Forum has endorsed this as amongst their voluntary consensus standards for hospital care. The Joint Commission has included it in its perinatal care quality measure set, and it has support from health care quality promotion advocacy groups, obviously the March of Dimes and also the Leapfrog group. And what's wrong with delivering a baby between 37 or 38 weeks? Because these are term babies. Well, there's a significant short-term morbidity for newborns delivered before 39 weeks. There's nearly a doubling of the risk for admission to the neonatal intensive care unit, an increase in respiratory complications and other complications as shown here for each week below 39 weeks the baby is born. In addition, there's risks for the developing fetal brain. And again, this is a slide provided by the March of Dimes, and it sort of lists the issues that occur with the development of the brain. But if you look in the bottom right corner, this is a graphic that's used in an education piece for physicians to educate parents about the issue of waiting if you have a healthy pregnancy to let that baby come when that baby's ready, because in those final weeks of pregnancy, the brain is really fully developing, and you can see that it takes on two-thirds of its weight, or an additional third of its weight in those last 5 weeks. So the upshot is that if the pregnancy is healthy, there's every reason to wait until at least 39 weeks to deliver. So I mentioned that Florida joined with California, Illinois, New York, Texas to be part of the Big Five. And the Big Five refers to them being the five states that have some of the largest number of births. They account for 40% of the births in the United States. And they're a focus of the efforts of the March of Dimes to try to address premature birth. So they're doing quality improvement projects with those states. They're working with those states to do that. This is one of the first ones. The Big Five initiative to eliminate non-medically indicated deliveries. And this was it's a pilot test of a toolkit to educate medical personnel to avoid scheduling these deliveries unless there's a medical reason to do so. We had quality improvement teams in each hospital work to change policies and procedures, including developing a scheduling form and specific criteria in their hospital. They collected data on how many deliveries that were done that were scheduled deliveries, and they shared information with other hospitals through monthly conference calls. The project started in late 2010 with the hospitals working on their policy development and such, and then they kicked off at the beginning of 2011 and through that entire year. So elements of the initiative included medical staff education through grand rounds, distribution of patient education materials developed by the March of Dimes, monthly conference calls for problem solving and guidance, data submission and consultation and technical assistance as was needed. This shows you where the six Big Five pilot hospitals in Florida were located. We're not actually allowed to tell you which hospitals they are at this point. But you can see that most of them were in sort of the southern area of the state. Two were in the Fort Lauderdale area, and then there's the one that's up there in the panhandle. To cut to the chase, the work of the hospitals is evident here. You can see that as a group, the rates of non-medically indicated deliveries went from about 39% to 5% of all births. At 37 and 0 days and 38 and 6 days. Non-medically indicated C-sections declined dramatically from 53% to about 9% over the course of that 1 year. And to put into context, because remember the data is collected a little bit differently, we went back to our birth certificate data and wanted to look at how did those six hospitals, how do they look in terms of that. And you can see that they accelerated their downward trend in reducing non-medically indicated deliveries during the project period. So numbers and graphs tell a story, but there's always more to the story, and that's what I want to talk about with the balance of my time. In order to evaluate the work of our Florida hospitals, we interviewed those quality improvement teams at the midpoint of the project in July of 2011 and at the end in early 2012. We took detailed notes during these phone interviews and circulated summaries to both the interviewers and the interviewees to make sure that everybody agreed with what was said and if there was any corrections or clarifications to make. And then we consolidated their responses and looked at them by topic area and such to look for recurring themes. Just to show you a little bit about the hospitals themselves, there was some diversity in the hospitals. They had, in comparison to hospitals in the other big five states, some fairly high rates of deliveries by cesarean sections and inductions. All but one of these hospitals were in an urban setting. The one that was up in the panhandle was the rural one. Each of the hospitals felt that their project was a success. I think the graph that I showed is a testament to that. And there are a few things that they felt were key to that success, and I would sum that up in two words. One is people, that is doctors, nurses, and hospital staff matter, and data matter. The need for a well-respected physician to champion the cause and lead the change effort could not possibly be overstated. The physician champion advocated for the project, kept other physicians in line, and served as a final authority on any scheduling exceptions. They were really key to implementing scheduling guidelines and enforcing hospital policy. Four of our hospitals noted that their physician champion promoted the work through going on TV community affairs segment shows, doing news articles or commenting for the media, and they really served as a public face for the effort. Probably even more important than physician champions were the staff. Nurses were absolutely critical to the success of the project and essentially drove it. Nurses took the lead in educating physicians and their staff and the community about the initiative, many of them making visits to private physician offices and taking them patient education materials so they would be aware of what the hospital policy was and so they could educate their patients as well. Hospital teams talked of the critical importance of their nurses being empowered to enforce the scheduling guidelines with doctors, knowing that they had the institutional support of a policy and also the clinical support of somebody who was a champion, one of the docs, to serve as the hard stop final authority. The scheduling staff were also key in some of the larger facilities where they're not in the same location as the labor and delivery staff. One of the hospitals, when they were commenting, they said, "Our schedulers are dogs who see the policy as a personal crusade and are persistent in enforcing the scheduling criteria." And nurses were also critical in generating event reports and pushing for peer review in cases that fell out where there was a violation of the scheduling criteria. And they also worked to include monitoring non-medically indicated deliveries as a quality measure in their own hospital. A critical component behind the success of the Big Five project was the rapid communication of data results to the hospitals. Each month they entered data on their non-medically indicated deliveries into a March of Dimes portal that was specially developed for the project. And then each following month they got that data back in graphs and charts that could show their activity and show it over time. So these reports helped each hospital monitor their progress, and it was also used for their own internal department meetings and quality committees. One site was able to detect a consistent pattern in one of the physician's scheduling requests so they could identify him and work to re-educate him. One of the hospitals kept a dashboard on their labor and delivery unit to keep staff apprised of their work and as a constant reminder of their progress in moving forward and moving the rate downward. Hospitals also used their own data when they needed to. One site tracked data on the number of NICU transfers in the first quarter of 2010 and use that to demonstrate to the physicians that they needed to do something about these deliveries. And interestingly, physicians often, obstetricians often don't know what happens to the baby once it's born. And so Being able to show them that kind of data was vital for securing their buy-in and their participation in the project. As you might expect, there were some challenges for the Florida hospitals. This wasn't unique to them. This is also the case for other hospitals in the Big Five. All of them encountered some amount of resistance from doctors who didn't want to be told how to practice or who were simply used to the usual order of things and wanted to continue to schedule to avoid having a delivery on a weekend or to make sure they could accommodate their vacation. And this was especially true for those cases at 38 weeks and 5 or 6 days that fell on a Friday. The physician didn't want to have to come in over the weekend and didn't want it to wait till Monday, so they would try to push to get the delivery done on a Friday. And you would think that that time period doesn't, that couple of days doesn't make a difference, but the data show otherwise. Hospital teams also reported dealing with efforts to get around the guidelines by trying to put something on the books on the weekends when the schedulers weren't working, so going in to write it in. Or to send a patient through urgent care so they would bypass regular admission. One hospital told of discovering a doctor who asked the patient to misrepresent the fetal movement she was experiencing so that she could get in for delivery. In terms of charting issues, one hospital found patient records that were sometimes noted as plus or minus 2 weeks for the gestational age, which is kind of odd. Or someone changing a chart to say that there was a medical indication, but then there was no documentation to back up that. And then I think something that was really difficult for two of our hospitals is they scheduled these deliveries so far in advance. They had a half year's worth of already scheduled deliveries that they had to clear from their books before they could actually fully implement the guidelines, and so it slowed their progress, and it may have confused the clinicians who were being told that there was a policy and criteria in place, and yet there were still these deliveries going on. So despite the challenges, there were tremendous successes. Virtually all commented on the novelty of seeing women come into the hospital in active labor. And you could hear the joy in the voices of the interviewed nursing staff on this issue. They're the ones that usually see the results of the early term deliveries and the babies going to the step-down nurseries or the NICUs. Most hospitals actually reported a reduction in NICU transfers, and one noted in particular that since there was less need for a neonatologist to come in and intervene and attend at birth, they could actually attend to doing their work in the NICU. And could even open the facility to take sick babies from other area hospitals. One hospital estimated it saved over $70,000 in NICU costs by reducing admission of these early-term babies. They went from having 74 early-term admissions in 2010 to only 2 during the 2011 Big Five project. And of course, as I showed you earlier, the project reduced rates of non-medically indicated deliveries, and it reduced the percentage of early-term deliveries overall in the participating hospitals. The need for this work continues and is continuing, as evidenced by the blue line here that represents the next wave of hospitals in Florida that our collaborative is working with to implement and use this March of Dimes toolkit to reduce these kinds of deliveries. We're working with our Florida Hospital Association and the March of Dimes to launch at least 20, I've heard, but we now may have a lot more than that, hospitals through a HEN or a hospital engagement network. They're going to use the same procedures as the Big Five pilot hospitals and are already learning lessons from those hospitals. They had some of their members came to present at a kickoff meeting that we had with the HEN hospitals last month, and they participate in the coaching calls that we have with those hospitals as well. In addition, we're continuing efforts to educate medical professionals in Florida on the issue, and we're involved in this. If any of you were at some other sessions, you've heard about this collaborative Improvement and Innovation Network, COIN. It's an ongoing HRSA initiative to reduce infant mortality and improve birth outcomes in the 13 southeastern states. Looking at non-medically indicated deliveries is one of the strategy areas for that COIN. Our Florida Perinatal Quality Collaborative is committed to spreading this initiative across the state of Florida and hopefully the results. For more information about this or other quality improvement efforts that we're involved in, you can visit our website or our Facebook page, and I thank you so much. Yeah. And I can try to answer questions.
Yeah. I've been with a team collecting data, the extraction from medical records, and one of the variables that we're looking at is mode of delivery, and I'm so fascinated by your work. It's really so important. But we have over 400 that we've extracted so far, and for all the C-sections, none of them say non-medically indicated for the rationale for the C-section. Mm-hmm. They all say some reason. And I'm wondering if there's sort of an equal sign between scheduled and non-medically indicated as you put all the data together. Is that the trigger for calling it non-medically indicated?
No, I mean, there's a fairly lengthy list of indications that are considered medical indications for a birth, and there are plenty. I think the thing that it's important to emphasize is that this is work in trying to eliminate early term deliveries in healthy pregnancies. So there's absolutely no reason to schedule someone to be induced or to have a C-section in these particular pregnancies. There are lots of reasons that women are induced or scheduled for C-sections because of medical problems. So you would want, I think, to look at whatever those indications are that are on those charts and compare it to, there's a list that the Joint Commission has out. I'm trying to think of who else. Somebody else may remember. It's escaping me. But there's a... ACOG,
that might be on the medical record would indicate evidence of non-medically indicated based on the criteria you all were using. You must have been working with similar kinds of data.
We were really looking at, I mean, this was the data after it was put into the portal, so I don't know that I can tell you exactly if there's any. Others may know some of those, though. And I'm not a physician either, so that's part of, or do you were...
Is there any thought of taking this scale and implementing it in virtually every hospital? What are the options for sort of compelling that?
They're different. Obviously, the big five states are doing the work in their states, but this is something that's going on all across the country. It's really taken on some steam. I know that it's now that it's going to be part of the Joint Commission's perinatal quality measure set, and hospitals are going to need to be reporting on it. And that's sort of one of the things I think that will start to push institutions to have to look at this issue, is they're going to have to report on it in order to have accreditation.
A couple of things connected to that. How long has that been a quality measure that the Joint Commission has been looking at?
I wish I did. I'm sorry, I don't.
Mm, our,
good.
Hypothesis is that people are looking at it now. But the other part was that you mentioned the decrease in days in the neonatal care units. Now, our hospitals may not view that as a big success because
no.
Their Medicaid payment rates
right.
are so much higher when babies are in the NICU than otherwise there's been a
right.
lot of interest in having babies.
Yeah, there is, and I don't know what you say to people that have that view. And that's so you would rather have a sick baby to get the money for it than to try to avoid having the sick baby to begin with. I mean, it for hospital people, and I think it for people who work in the field and see the results of those those kinds of deliveries, it's a no-brainer. It makes absolutely no sense. I was hoping that was just a really, like, an outlier kind of issue. Well, and I know there's efforts. I think one of the things that the March of Dimes is working on now is to be more, to move more on the patient education side. We actually have a whole separate project in the state of Florida. One of our Healthy Start coalitions, and we have a state Healthy Start system in addition to a federal Healthy Start, and they're working on a statewide initiative to broaden education on the issue. And their baseline data indicates actually they've already started to, that's already started to happen. But wait, there's, you.
I was just going to make a comment. I'm
sorry.
State of Oklahoma, I'm with a bunch of guys. And
Oklahoma, I know, has been doing great work.
We've seen, we've had 52 of our 59 Brigham hospitals. Mm-hmm.
Not medically,
yes.
Right.
And we've seen today in our year that we've had a collaborative a 70% decrease, which is huge. But I think the point that you made is very well taken, that now we're starting to look at the hospitals that are having some pushback, mm-hmm. that are not quite on board, having a bit of a struggle, is that their NICU, they're very large hospitals, and the amount of money that is generated from them.
Right.
And so really taking a look at, you know, this is an issue that, yes, we should be doing this, but
right. Well, and
right,
right, and that's
create,
and I know that Texas in particular has now their Medicaid basically has said they will not pay, and that's another way to go about doing it, is that you get the pressure from the insurance companies or from Medicaid, because and for many of our states, I know our state, it's close to 50%, others 50% or more of their births are paid for by Medicaid. So that's an argument you make to your state legislatures, and they can decide to do what they want. But when it comes to money, they're going to probably side on the part that might save them some.
But, I just have a couple things to say. One, thank you very much for your presentation.
Sure.
Our Improving Pregnancy Outcomes Committee of the Maternal Child Health Section had decided actually at this meeting that we needed a policy on the books at APHA. So that way you can go to your local, state, and federal legislators and advocate on this issue. So I
Excellent.
Really appreciate your, and I'd like to talk to you more about
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, that's great.
I have a thought from you, which is I'm wondering if you're just looking at the reason for the C-section. I'm assuming most insurance will not pay for an elective C-section. And I'm thinking
yeah.
after what happened to you, that you would need to actually look at the reasons people would
right.
take C-sections before you implemented your program.
Yeah,
and
there's
after to see which were the ones that
the ones that we're looking at are all Medicaid and uninsured.
Yeah,
so I have the reason for the C-section. Mm-hmm. So you know, there I'm assuming maybe. I mean, you're thinking they are all. I'd like to invite our other speakers to come sit up
yeah.
case, and I'm going to open up the questions to all of our speakers now. So, and you know,
please,
you
yeah.
And, could you ask me a question?
The number 39 weeks. Is there some hard scientific reason why it was set there? Over 33 years, I've watched our tendency to where we say we should have the baby just kind of gradually shrink down, and Why not 40 weeks?
Yeah, why not 40 weeks? Actually, I know that there was some discussion at the prematurity prevention symposium in D.C. in January about how artificially the dates for what is term or what is preterm and such were determined. And so there's some talk of moving those time periods. But the data that's been coming out over the last 5 to 10 years really shows, and I don't have it with me, but the slides that were from the March of Dimes has put together, it's a physician education slide set, and it's used in the Grand Rounds presentations that they do in the hospitals to educate the staff. It shows sort of the U-shaped curve of the poor outcomes over the gestational months, weeks. So 37, 38, 39, it starts out higher and then it dips down at 39. And then once you hit about 40, 41, 42, the prevalence of poor outcomes they don't go up as high as they are at 38 and 37, 36 weeks. But they're, that little sweet spot there at 37, 39, and 40 weeks seems to be an optimal time. And that's, I think, also why there are medical reasons that come up for deliveries after that or before, but certainly for after. I think you're right, and that's what the data show too. When there's an article that asks women about when's it safe to deliver. Well, what is 9 months? How many weeks? Let's see, 9 times 4 is 36. People think 36 weeks is fine, and 36 weeks is definitely not fine. I think you're absolutely right. It will probably happen eventually, but remember, this is stuff that ACOG and others have known about and have had their own guidelines about for decades. It takes a long time to change practice and a long time to change systems, and at least the work is starting.
Brain development. Mm-hmm. You talked about this important period for brain development, but the only really question I have is, if the baby comes out early, do we have research to show that that would affect the brain development in those weeks?
This is what the data show on the issue. Remember, that's population based, and I think individual births are different. You're going to have babies who are born early that have no issues whatsoever, but they're more likely to have developmental issues if they're born early, premature, obviously, but even the ones that are in that early term period.
They're not relating that to having seizures, so they're thinking that because
Well, once the baby's out, there is no more. The brain is where it is usually at that point. I mean, they then start to do the brain does other things, but we have Dr. Stanley Graven has done a tremendous amount of work on the neonatal brain and its development. And he could tell you all about it. I wish I had some of his slides here to show, but it does. There's a connection with the development of the brain while it's in utero, and those connections obviously are gone once the baby is born. And so a different process starts to take over after that. That's as much as I know. Again, I'm not a physiologist either. I'm a sociologist, actually, by training.
I'd like to raise another really important point for advocates. One thing people can do is find out what day of the week the majority of births are. And if you start to see they're all on Fridays, you know something's going on. And that was something a researcher in our community did.
Yeah.
And it was so clustered. And also the time of day.
Yeah.
When people want to go home. So those kinds of things are really good indications.
Mm-hmm. Regarding your preterm delivery, the preterm cesarean section, did anyone look at stratifying by age to look for indications or outcomes? Because there's some evidence that women of advanced maternal age should be cesareans or
I don't think anyone has looked at any of that. And I don't think actually in the data portal that the March of Dimes had, if we collected any real demographic information on the women, which it is unfortunate when you bring that up. but I'm not positive about that, but I'm fairly sure. But that would certainly be something that would be worth looking at.
One more thing I was curious about is there was sort of the rise of these non-medically indicated births until about 2007, 2008, mm-hmm. and then even in the hospitals, which were exceptionally high, it starts to decline. What happened in 2007, 2008?
I think there's just been increasing attention to the issue, and some of the data started to come out about the adverse outcomes for those births.
Any other questions? I would like us all to give another really big round of applause.